May it please the Court, Alexander Funk on behalf of the appellant, Jermaine Hoskins. It's well settled law in Delaware that a defendant is entitled to a specific jury instruction concerning an accomplice witness's credibility when an accomplice is an admitted accomplice as part of that case. This Court's opinion in Smith v. State from 2010, 991 Atlantic 2nd, 1169, ratified and reaffirmed a holding from 40 years prior in Bland v. State. The court had some very specific concerns and considerations regarding accomplice testimony. One of those is that defendant is entitled to a specific jury instruction regarding accomplice credibility, and that jury instruction should be separate and apart from... Well,
prior to Smith, was that upon request or in every case it must be given?
Generally, it was upon request.
Okay, so what is Smith? Hold. Does that require now that it be given?
It's the appellant's position that Smith holds that by rule now it must be given in positions or cases where accomplice testimony is a factor or at least one part of the evidence.
Whether or not it's requested?
That's correct.
So is that a new rule?
That's the appellant's position, Your Honor.
Well, then, why should it be retroactive?
It should be retroactive in the sense that when looking at retroactivity of new rules, there are certain circumstances under which they can apply to cases that were decided prior to. I think in this case, while Smith v. State established a new rule, it also reaffirmed existing law that was already out there. So I think under the plain error standard, it can be applied retroactively to the Hoskins case because Smith really reaffirmed Bland from 40 years ago.
What is the how does the doctrine of harmless error fit into that analysis?
Well, Your Honor, the error that occurred in this case, and I'm assuming Your Honor's looking for an answer along the lines of what was the prejudicial impact that the appellant suffered. This is a case where, while some of the evidence or some of the testimony from Alonzo West, who was the co-defendant and the accomplice who testified, was corroborated, the significant, at least from the appellant's point of view, the most significant portions of that testimony was not corroborated. The only evidence about who used the Ruger 9mm in this case, which through ballistics testing was determined to be the weapon that fired the projectile that killed Brandon Beard, the only evidence came from Alonzo West.
So you're saying that there can't be harmless error because the accomplice's testimony was critical to the conviction?
It's critical, and when looked at with the 3507 previous out-of-court statement that came in, how that was used to, in effect, sort of build up Mr. West's credibility before the jury in closing arguments, had a synergistic effect, I believe, where the jury was instructed that they're allowed to find Mr. Hoskins guilty strictly based on accomplice liability theory, based on Mr. West's testimony. His previous out-of-court statements are then admitted under 3507.
But if you put to one side for a moment the 3507 statement and just focus on the accomplice's trial testimony, was that testimony sufficient to break the tie? That is, was it a he said?
The appellant's position is that Alonzo West's testimony very well could have been the determining factor between a murder second conviction, a manslaughter conviction, or not guilty.
Does the record reflect why an accomplice liability or an accomplice credibility instruction was not requested?
Your Honor, what I can state about that is it was not requested. It is plain error. It was a matter of oversight. This is a case where I represented the appellant at the trial below. The state's case preceding prayer instructions or prayer conference was on principle theory of liability. At the prayer conference, the state requested the ability to include an accomplice liability instruction. At the time, in the heat of the moment, I objected to the accomplice liability request. It was subsequently granted anyway. I would agree that, strictly speaking, it's a plain error case because it wasn't properly preserved by defense counsel at that time. But I would also make the argument that given the circumstances surrounding the accomplice liability instruction request, given defense counsel's objection at that point to the request being given, the better practice is to better articulate that you want the accomplice credibility instruction in there as well. And looking back on it, it should have been done. But it's a matter of oversight, not necessarily.
Was the issue of credibility argued before the jury?
It was. But as I'd point out, or as I'd like to illustrate, there are cases, presumably, principally in the Third Circuit, that sort of have a different approach to accomplice credibility than Delaware. Accomplice credibility through the Third Circuit, through a couple different cases, principally U.S. v. Isaac and U.S. v. Zember, they were asked, the court in those two cases, in both cases, were asked to establish a new rule that for every case involving accomplice testimony, an accomplice credibility instruction be given. The circuit court declined that request in both cases, and it was for two reasons. First, the court held that, first, the defense attorney was able to cross-examine the accomplice witness as to credibility and argue those points that he developed on the record at summation. The court held that put the jury on notice that they should put special concern on the accomplice's testimony. And the second part is, when considering that in conjunction with the general witness credibility instruction for both cases, and they, while not memorizing them, they both generally said the jurors in those cases had the ultimate authority to decide issues of credibility among witnesses. Looking at those two things together, they didn't believe it was error, and they declined, or error not to include the instruction, and they declined to issue a new rule establishing that it has to be included for every case thereafter. That differs from Delaware in that in Smith v. State, this court explicitly rejected the notion that being able to merely argue points made on cross regarding credibility in summation, that's not a sufficient a substitution for specific credibility instruction.
Well, what are the particular facts and circumstances of this case that you suggest should lead us to conclude that there was prejudice? Because in Smith we said it's not necessarily prejudicial per se not to give this instruction.
The specific facts and circumstances here that what the appellant asserts changes the case from perhaps a murder one to a murder two to a manslaughter result into an acquittal all rest and reside in the testimony of Alonzo West. Alonzo West testified, and it was not corroborated by any other evidence, that it was the appellant and the appellant's brother who organized this group of individuals to go from one neighborhood to the other neighborhood. Alonzo West testified, and it was uncorroborated by other evidence, that it was the appellant's goal to target Jermaine Brown, and that in targeting Jermaine Brown, subsequently killed Brandon Beard. That's all uncorroborated.
It sounds as if the response that you made to Justice Richley's question is a factual response, but conceptually, you know, how do you put all those facts together to get to your bottom line that that there was prejudice sufficient to warrant reversal?
The prejudice suffered by my client is that my client did testify in contravention to the facts that Alonzo West testified to. Because there was no credibility instruction that was given to the jury wasn't given the proper framework to view Alonzo West's testimony.
So you're saying without the instruction, the jury did not know, or at least we cannot be confident that the jury knew how to evaluate the accomplice testimony, correct?
I think that's a big question in this case, Your Honor. We
but,
don't
but
know.
Isn't that true in any case where an accomplice instruction isn't given?
Each case is different.
That may be. But if there, you know, if it takes the instruction for the jury to be properly informed about its function, and there is no instruction, then wouldn't it follow that the failure to give that instruction, at least absent a strategic decision not to request one, would be prejudicial?
I believe it is, at least in the the circumstances at the case at bar.
Well, your candor is commendable in saying that this was an oversight on your part. But as a matter of appellate review, it creates a dilemma for us because you're arguing plain error, which means the trial judge committed plain error by not giving something you didn't request. And your exchange with Justice Ridgely and Justice Jacobs demonstrates that the real focus is prejudice. And if it really was oversight on your part, then that's why we deal with claims of ineffective assistance of counsel in Rule 61 proceedings, because there we look at the two parts of Strickland, cause and prejudice, and we now know the cause is oversight. We also know after Smith that it's not reversible error per se. So the entire focus in a Rule 61 proceeding would be on prejudice, where a full record on prejudice could be developed. So why isn't our traditional approach of dealing with attorney oversight in the Rule 61 context the better way to proceed than through plain error in a direct appeal?
Your Honor, I'd reply to that by saying that given the particular facts and circumstances of this case, I believe, Your Honor, allow me, I'll back up. The case was presented as a principal theory of liability. At the prayer conference, the state requested the accomplice liability instruction. While I should have articulated my complete thoughts and my complete feelings on the matter in terms of not just objecting to the accomplice liability instruction, but also requesting an accomplice credibility instruction, I believe that my response at the time should have been enough sua sponte. And I know this is a difficult argument to make, and I have to be careful in the way I make it, but I believe that there were enough attendant facts and circumstances where, given the nature of the objection and the discussions that we had on the record about this, that it was error not to, as a matter of caution, issue that jury instruction on accomplice.
And I understand that, but if you look at our cases generally, whether we use the word required upon request or required, what we see developing is our court saying you're entitled to it if you ask for something in certain circumstances. So, for example, a crime that's divided into degrees where mental state is at issue, we've said you're entitled to have the lesser included instruction upon request. And as recently as December, we wrote a case that made it clear, if you decide not to do that, we'd like a record that it was a conscious decision not to do it, because we want to avoid this plain error Rule 61 dilemma. And we need to figure out a way to make sure the trial counsel do that so we're not guessing whether it was a strategy or an oversight.
And, Your Honor, in reply to that, I would say that while it is the law of the land that parties are entitled to certain jury instructions if there's a basis in the law for giving them, both state and defense, one thing that is absolutely paramount and one thing that I believe is the law of the land as well is that the defendant and the appellant is entitled to an accurate and correct statement of the law, regardless of whether the state requests a jury instruction or the defendant requests a jury instruction.
Well, we agree. What I'm trying to get you to help the court with is our effort to get to the correct result based on a proper record. And the dilemma is sometimes in a direct appeal, if the real issue is prejudice, the record's not as completely developed as it would be in a Rule 61 proceeding.
And my response to that would be, Your Honor, respectfully, I think that the chances that this led to the jury not being properly instructed as to how to consider all the facts and evidence and all of the contested testimony and evidence, the fact that we can't be sure whether that had the impact it didn't. From the appellant's perspective, it had an impact.
Right, but West's testimony, I realize you're concerned about all of his testimony, is that he only owned a 9mm gun. He didn't own a .22. He brought it along at your client's request. Your client admitted grabbing the gun that was in the console, jumping out of the car and firing it, although he said he fired it in the air to scare people away. But the subsequent ballistic reports showed that it was a 9mm that matched West's 9mm that actually resulted in the homicide. Is that right?
Well, Your Honor, that is right, with a couple of exceptions. The appellant was never asked by the police if he fired a 9mm or a 22. His testimony was he fired a 22 that Alonzo West owned, that Alonzo West provided to him. There was a fingerprint that was found on the 9mm that was tested against my client and was negative. There were 22 caliber bullets that were found in Alonzo West's possession. I believe that all things considered.
Was there testimony, just so that we have the factual predicate for your argument, that as to what happened to the 22 from your client?
As to his actions with it?
What happened after the shooting?
He testified that he gave it back to Alonzo West. So all things considered, if the jury, the appellant believes that if the jury had been properly instructed on how to weigh the credibility of Alonzo West's testimony, which, as the record reflects, Alonzo West had relatives who were at the scene, relatives who were involved in this, arguably, as I was able to develop on the record and argue in summation, he had a motive for protecting someone who may have used the weapon, someone who may not have been in the field of fingerprint analysis that, you know, the gun was sent through. If the jury had been properly instructed about Mr. West's credibility concerns or how to consider his credibility, the fact that there were 22 bullets that were found in his belongings, the fact that he's the only link to the 9mm and my client, the fact that Mr. West had 9mm in his possession when he was arrested. It was back at his girlfriend's premises. From the appellant's perspective, the jury had been properly instructed on the credibility issues. This really could have changed the whole ballgame.
You're into the time you've reserved. Do you want to save
that? I would like to reserve that, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Williams, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Justice Hollum, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely. May it please the Court, the State will address the one argument that's been presented today. That is the first argument in the appellant's opening brief. But if the Court has any questions concerning either of the other two arguments, I'll certainly be happy to try to answer those as well. The first argument is a plain error claim that the trial judge should sua sponte have given the jury a specific accomplice credibility instruction. As it's been pointed out in Smith, as well as the Two-Third Circuit cases, Zemba and Isaac, that the Court asked the parties to review, there is no per se rule that requires in all cases dealing with potential accomplice liability that you have to have a specific accomplice credibility instruction. The Zemba and Isaac's case from the Third Circuit, in those cases, even though the defense had requested such instructions, they were not given, and those convictions were affirmed on appeal by the Third Circuit. The contention is a matter that's directed, as Smith says, this Court's decision, Smith, to the specific facts and circumstances in a particular case as to whether or not a specific accomplice credibility instruction need be given, and if not, what the result should be. And it's dependent on a number of factors. The ALR federal annotation that the Court also requested counsel to review talks about a variety of factors that courts review, federal courts at least. This was a federal annotation, a collection of federal cases in the annotation. The federal case law seems to be very similar to what the state law is in Delaware. And the factors include whether or not there is corroboration for the accomplice's testimony or not, whether or not there was a rigorous or vigorous defense cross-examination of the accomplice, and whether or not defense counsel had an opportunity to argue credibility to the jury whether or not there was a specific accomplice credibility instruction or not. The courts also look at whether or not a general witness credibility instruction is given or not. There was a general witness credibility instruction given in this particular case.
Well, and we dealt with all of those issues in Smith.
Yes, that's correct.
But at the end of Smith, we said it wasn't going to be error per se not to request an instruction. When you read that with the prior sentence that talks about it being required, it seems logical to read Smith as saying it's required upon request, so that the real focus would be on prejudice.
Yes, I think that's correct, and I think Smith also talks about it being the better practice, and the state would agree that it probably is the better practice, but the question we have here is, well, what happens when it's not requested by the defense? The judge, should the judge sua sponte give the instruction or not?
And that may not be the real issue about the judge sua sponte giving it as much as the judge sua sponte saying, do you want it or not? As you heard me mention to Mr. Funk, what we're trying to sort out in these cases is what's really going on. Are we having a strategic decision or are we having oversight? And it certainly makes it easier to apply the proper standard of appellate review if we know which it is. So how can we accomplish the goal of having the record clearly reflect that there's been a conscious decision to do something or not do something?
Well, I think, as Your Honor suggested, the clearest way to make that record is to ask defense counsel pointedly, do you want this instruction or do you not? And then we'll have a response and then we'll know, because there is a difference for appellate review whether something has been waived, consciously waived, because there's a strategic defense decision not to, as opposed to something that is oversight, that was merely overlooked. So certainly the best way to do it, I think, would be for the trial judge simply to ask.
Help me understand what defense strategy would be promoted by not asking the judge to say that the state's primary witness's testimony should be examined with suspicion and great caution. I mean, why would, as a matter of strategy, a lawyer not want that instruction given?
Well, I think as a matter of strategy, it probably goes to one of the state's alternative arguments, that is the state constitutional prohibition in Article 4, Section 19, that prohibits trial judges from charging juries as to matters of fact. The trial judges in Delaware can charge juries as to what the questions of fact are, and they can certainly charge the jury as to what the law is, declare the law. But if a defense attorney is concerned about this state constitutional objection, that would certainly be a reason not to have the instruction given if it's of questionable state constitutional validity.
Mr.
I think that is an open question.
To follow up on Justice Holland's point that the issue that seems to be pivotal here is prejudice, Do you read Smith as holding that the failure of a trial judge to give the accomplice credibility instruction is prejudicial, is or isn't prejudicial per se?
Well, I don't think it's prejudicial per se. I think it's the facts and circumstances test. You're going to have to look at what all the evidence was, and in particular in this case, I think it comes down to whether or not
you're saying that Smith does not do anything to alter that rule, that prejudice is a fact-specific inquiry.
Yes, I think that's correct. It says, as I recall, Smith says it's a facts and circumstances test, which normally means you've got to look at all the factors that were involved in the particular case and then decide whether it was or was not ultimately prejudicial.
If that's right, then I suppose it wouldn't matter if Smith was found to be retroactive, would it, at least in this case, since there was no request made
I don't know. I'm not sure about the retroactivity. That's a difficult thing. I know I argued that, and in thinking about it some more, I'm not sure if the state's position is entirely correct. I know on collateral review, at least,
well, the state's position, is that there is no per se prejudice resulting from a failure to give the accomplice credibility instruction, at least where it's not being asked for.
Yes, I think that's correct. It's not automatic error. Some of the
okay, and this is such a case, correct?
Well, I don't know if that's what's being argued or not. I think the argument being made by the appellant is both, that it was prejudicial and that it may be a per se rule. I'm not entirely sure what's being argued about
that.
Well,
that goes back to my question about having a clear record, because even if we assume hypothetically, Smith said it's required, and the judge said, I'm going to give this required instruction, couldn't defense counsel say, I don't want the instruction, I waive my right to have that instruction? I mean, we let people waive constitutional rights and all sorts of things. Why couldn't they waive a requirement? And to the extent they can, isn't that the kind of record we really want developed?
Well, I think they can waive it. And if it's a defense strategic position, yes, now it may be attacked on post-conviction later on that wasn't the shrewdest course, but you know, that's for another day. No, I think it certainly could in that context. And yes, that would be a clear-cut record, and it's much easier to deal with that as from the state's point of view as well.
So the facts and circumstances include basically the thinking of the defense lawyer, and while we've had a representation here today, it hasn't gone through the Rule 61 process where there's an opportunity to actually cross-examine the defense lawyer.
Yes, that's correct.
So is the facts and circumstances analysis, is it more suitable then to a Rule 61 analysis? Is that your view?
I don't know. I don't know if it is or isn't. I know it's Smith says it's facts and circumstances when the instruction's not been given here. When we get to Rule 61, I mean, I guess the controlling standard is Strickland. You have to look at would reasonable counsel have done that? Was it professionally derelict not to do it? And then even if it is, then was there ultimately prejudice, meaning there would have been a different result at trial?
Well, if prejudice under Smith is a facts and circumstances analysis, then that analysis would have to be undergone whether or not Smith is retroactive. So the retroactivity point wouldn't be a real issue in this case. Is that correct?
It may not.
Let me say it differently. It would be retroactivity would be important only if the failure of the trial court to give the accomplice credibility instruction were prejudicial per se.
Yes, I think if that was the new rule being promulgated, then
it would matter.
Then it would, yes.
But if there is no per se prejudice, and you know, prejudice is to be ascertained from the facts and circumstances, and it really doesn't matter.
No, I don't think this court would do a different analysis than you would prior to Smith using Bland and Cabrera and the other cases. The important thing, though, I think in this particular case is that, or two important things. One is that Alonzo Smith's credibility certainly was attacked by the defense counsel. It was pointed out to the jury that Alonzo West had already pled to second-degree murder and conspiracy, so they knew that about Alonzo West. And in addition, the crucial testimony, and Justice Hollins really pinpointed it, is the identity of the weapon that the accused, Mr. Hoskins, was firing. He says he was firing a gun. He says it was a .22 caliber revolver. Mr. West, in his trial testimony, there's actually two trials here, but we're really only concerned with a second trial and the second-degree murder conviction, because it doesn't really matter what the identity of the weapon was for the reckless endangering, whether it was a .22 or not. Mr. Hoskins could still be guilty of those reckless endangering charges and those companion firearm charges. But it is important for the second-degree murder conviction, because the murder weapon that's identified by ballistics is the 9mm. Mr. Alonzo West testifies that he does own 9mm. He says he's never owned a .22 caliber. When the police execute the search warrant 3 days after this fatal shooting, they go to Alonzo West's girlfriend's house. They find a blue gym bag, which Mr. West identifies at trial as being his gym bag. In that gym bag is 9mm Ruger that's ultimately determined to be the murder weapon, and a full box of .22 caliber ammunition. Mr. West says the .22 caliber ammunition really was not his. He found it in his car because his girlfriend has a small child. He put that box of ammunition in the gym bag along with a Ruger, but according to West, he never has the .22 caliber. So that's the only real difference between the testimony of West and Hoskins at trial. Both agree that Hoskins took the gun, whatever it was, a Ruger or a .22 caliber, got out of the car, the Buick, that Mr. West was driving that evening, fired shots into the air, and then returned. Mr. West's testimony says his car was parked away from the crowd. He did not look back at the crowd. He did not see Mr. Hoskins point a gun at anyone. And he also added that when Mr. Hoskins got back in the car, Mr. Hoskins said that he had fired in the air. The only incriminatory...
But what we see is that when we talk about corroboration of the accomplice testimony, the undisputed objective facts demonstrate West's 9mm gun was at the scene of the crime, and West's 9mm gun is the gun that was involved in the homicide. Is that right?
Yes, I think that's what it is. It's actual physical evidence, the 9mm that the police seized 3 days later, that corroborates Mr. West's claim that he had a 9mm, and that's the only handgun that he had. So I think in this case, unlike some of the other cases in this area, you do have corroboration of the one central disputed fact in the case. What was the weapon that Mr. Hoskins was firing that evening? Was it the 9mm Ruger, or was it the .22 caliber that Mr. Hoskins claimed? Police never find a .22 caliber. All they find is a box, a full box of ammunition. Now, at the scene, they find 12 spent shell casings. Five of those, I think, are 9mm Rugers, and I believe the other seven are .22s. So somebody may very well have been firing a .22 there at the scene. There were spent shell casings. And that's the crucial issue. But here you do have corroboration.
There is other evidence that there were two guns at the scene?
Well, I think there, yes, because of the shell casings.
Right, so the only issue was what gun was Mr. Hoskins firing?
Yes, I think that is it. And that's what's the difference between Wes and Hoskins' testimony. They're pretty much in agreement about all the other central facts. They're agreed that this caravan of cars went from Capitol Park to Capitol Green. They went over there.
Yes, on that critical factual issue, it's only Mr. West's testimony that puts the 9mm gun in Mr. Hoskins' hand. Isn't that right?
Yes, that's it. But it's corroborated by the fact that when the police go looking for this, all they find is a 9mm Ruger. They don't find a .22 caliber revolver.
That doesn't eliminate the possibility that the .22 caliber weapon was discarded at some point.
Oh, no, it doesn't eliminate that. But that's what, you know, those are general credibility questions that a jury has to resolve in all cases where there's competing testimony. And the jury did have an instruction about general credibility. So I think that was sufficient in this case. And that's why it's not plain error.
And does the record reflect where the shells were actually collected, and specifically where the 9mm shells and the .22 shells together? Because it's my understanding of the record, someone was firing shots before Hoskins grabbed the gun and got out, and that was the whole reason that he testified he was prompted to fire shots anyway in response to someone else firing. Is that correct?
That's what Hoskins testifies to, yes.
So if we assume this entire courtroom could be the crime scene, so mm-hmm. to speak, we could have the 9mm shells collected in one corner of the crime scene, but the .22 shells collected in another corner.
My question is, what does the record reflect on the proximity of the shells?
I don't recall exactly how close they are. I know they're all found at this location. It's Newcastle Avenue. It's a residential area. People are out on the street. I don't think the shells are right next to each other, but I don't know how far these two piles of shells are. I think the 9 millimeters are grouped in some fashion. I'm not sure what proximity, and that the other shells, the other seven shell casings, rather, are at a different location. They're separated.
So either the same person had to be using two different guns in two different locations, but there had to be two people shooting two different guns.
Well, I think that's the latter is the more probable, because that was the whole purpose of this caravan of four or five cars going over. And there was testimony from Mr. Hoskins. It's not disputed by anyone else that other shots were ringing out. And the question is just, you know, was he firing a 9 millimeter or was he firing a 22 caliber, as he claims? But the corroboration here is the physical evidence that's collected by the police. So I think this is not a case where there's no corroboration of Mr. West. There is corroboration to some extent in the sense that the police, when they go looking for this physical evidence, all they find is a 9 millimeter, and they find a full box of 22s, which wouldn't indicate that ammunition was being taken from that box, because if there's seven spent shell casings of 22s at the scene, you would expect seven shells to be missing from the box. So there's some credence to Mr. West's claim that, well, he just found a full box of ammunition. Wasn't for his gun, but he kept it in the gym bag to keep it away from his girlfriend's child. If there's any additional questions, I'll be happy to try to answer those.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Funk, you have about 2.5 minutes.
Your Honor, first, I hope I'm not stepping on any toes here, but I do have a duty as an officer of the court to inform the court that, you know, as trial counsel, I'm aware that the shell casings were all 9-millimeter variety. There were no 22 caliber shell casings found at the scene. I can fill in some gaps as far as the placement of the shell casings, because I was out there and measured the distance myself. But I believe...
Is that in the record, or is...
That's in the record. As far as the distance, that... Right. The estimate from one of the police officers on cross-examination is in the record.
And what was that?
Generally, there were two different sort of concentric circles, about, you know, 5 yards around, that contained one grouping of five shells, about 12 feet up the block towards the actual crime scene where the victim was found, about 12 to 15 feet up was another grouping of about 5 to 6 feet radius of the seven 9-millimeter shell casings.
Thank you very much.
Well, Mr. Williams argued that the only real issue in dispute is what gun was Mr. Hoskins fired. The appellant would say that there's more in dispute than just that. The whole reason for going to this neighborhood is in dispute. Tremaine Hoskins testified that a friend of his was supposed to get into a fight with someone, and he was going over there to back him up. Mr. West testified that this was some sort of coordinated scheme among the Hoskins brothers to target one particular individual, Jermaine Brown. There's nothing to corroborate that statement by Mr. West. It's true, this group of people did go from one neighborhood to the other neighborhood, but the reason and rationale behind it is in dispute. There's testimony from Mr. West that as they were driving along Newcastle Avenue there, about to come up to the curve where the car stopped, that Mr. Hoskins made a comment, there's, you know, Jermaine's ride, or there's Jermaine's car. There's no corroboration at all about that. That's the only link, or the only evidence of that is Mr. West's own testimony. I see him quickly running out of time. Quite simply, we would just say that there was enough in play here that if the jury had been properly instructed as to how to consider Mr. West's credibility, it could have had a very markedly different result. So with that, I'll cede any questions.
Thank you very much. Thank you both. the court will take this matter under advisement, and we'll also take a brief recess.
Please rise.